Chapter 67. That I was glad of the opportunity. I remember faces very well. So do I, miss, he returned, meeting my look with the fullness of his dark eyes and broad forehead. Humph. What set me off, now, upon that? His once more reddening through his brown, and being disconcerted by his efforts to remember the association brought my guardian to his relief. Have you many pupils, Mr. George? They vary in their number, sir. Mostly they're but a small lot to live by. And what classes of chance people come to practice at your gallery? All sorts, sir. Natives and foreigners. From gentlemen to apprentices. I have had French women come, before now, and show themselves dabs at pistol shooting. Mad people out of number, of course, but they go everywhere, where the doors stand open. People don't come with grudges and schemes of finishing their practice with live targets, I hope, said my guardian, smiling. Not much of that, sir, though that has happened. Mostly they come for skill or idleness. Six of one, and half a dozen of the other. I beg your pardon, said Mr. George, sitting stiffly upright and squaring an elbow on each knee, but I believe you're a chancery suitor, if I have heard correct. I am sorry to say I am. I have had one of your compatriots in my time, sir. A chancery suitor? Returned my guardian. How was that? Why, the man was so badgered and worried and tortured by being knocked about from post to pillar, and from pillar to post, said Mr. George, that he got out of sorts. I don't believe he had any idea of taking aim at anybody, but he was in that condition of resentment and violence, that he would come and pay for 50 shots and fire away till he was red hot. One day I said to him, when there was nobody by, and he had been talking to me angrily about his wrongs, if this practice is a safety valve, comrade, well and good. But I don't altogether like your being so bent upon it in your present state of mind. I'd rather you took to something else. Apostrophe I was on my guard for a blow, he was that passionate. But he received it in very good part and left off directly. We shook hands and struck up a sort of friendship. What was that man? Asked my guardian in a new tone of interest. Why, he began by being a small Shropshire farmer, before they made a baited bull of him, said Mr. George. Was his name Gridley? It was, sir. Mr. George directed another succession of quick bright glances at me as my guardian, and I exchanged a word or two of surprise at the coincidence, and I therefore explained to him how we knew the name. He made me another of his soldierly bows in acknowledgement of what he called my condescension. I don't know, he said as he looked at me, what it is that sets me off again but bosh. What's my head running against? He passed one of his heavy hands over his crisp dark hair, as if to sweep the broken thoughts out of his mind, and sat a little forward, with one arm akimbo and the other resting on his leg, looking in a brown study at the ground. I am sorry to learn that the same state of mind has got this Gridley into new troubles, and that he is in hiding, said my guardian. So I am told, sir, returned Mr. George, still musing and looking on the ground. So I am told. You don't know where? No, sir, returned the trooper, lifting up his eyes and coming out of his reverie. I can't say anything about him. He will be worn out soon, I expect. You may file a strong man's heart away for a good many years, but it will tell all of a sudden at last. Richard's entrance stopped the conversation. Mr. George rose, made me another of his soldierly bows, wished my guardian a good day, and strode heavily out of the room. This was the morning of the day appointed for Richard's departure. We had no more purchases to make now. I had completed all his packing early in the afternoon, and our time was disengaged until night, when he was to go to Liverpool for Holyhead. Jarndyce and Jarndyce being again expected to come on that day, Richard proposed to me that we should go down to the court and hear what passed. As it was his last day, and he was eager to go, and I had never been there, I gave my consent, and we walked down to Westminster, where the court was then sitting. We beguiled the way with arrangements concerning the letters that Richard was to write to me, and the letters that I was to write to him, and with a great many hopeful projects. My guardian knew where we were going, and therefore was not with us. When we came to the court, there was the Lord Chancellor, the same whom I had seen in his private room in Lincoln's Inn, sitting in great state and gravity on the bench, with the mace and seals on a red table below him, and an immense flat nosegay, like a little garden, which scented the whole court. Below the table, again, was a long row of solicitors, with bundles of papers on the matting at their feet. And then there were the gentlemen of the bar in wigs, and gowns, some awake and some asleep, and one talking, and nobody paying much attention to what he said. The Lord Chancellor leaned back in his very easy chair with his elbow on the cushioned arm, and his forehead resting on his hand. Some of those who were present dozed. Some read the newspapers. Some walked about or whispered in groups. All seemed perfectly at their ease, by no means in a hurry, very unconcerned, and extremely comfortable. To see everything going on so smoothly, and to think of the roughness of the suitors' lives and deaths, to see all that full dress and ceremony, and to think of the waste, and want, and beggared misery it represented. To consider that, while the sickness of hope deferred was raging in so many hearts, this polite show went calmly on from day to day, and year to year, in such good order and composure. To behold the Lord Chancellor and the whole array of practitioners under him looking at one another, and at the spectators, as if nobody had ever heard that all over England the name in which they were assembled was a bitter jest, was held in universal horror, contempt, and indignation, was known for something so flagrant and bad, that little short of a miracle, could bring any good out of it to anyone. This was so curious and self-contradictory to me, who had no experience of it, that it was at first incredible, and I could not comprehend it. I sat where Richard put me, and tried to listen, and looked about me. But there seemed to be no reality in the whole scene except poor little Miss Flight, the madwoman, standing on a bench and nodding at it. Miss Flight soon espied us, and came to where we sat. She gave me a gracious welcome to her domain and indicated, with much gratification and pride, its principal attractions. Mr. Kenge also came to speak to us, and did the honors of the place in much the same way, with the bland modesty of a proprietor. It was not a very good day for a visit, he said. He would have preferred the first day of term, but it was imposing, it was imposing. When we had been there half an hour or so, the case in progress, if I may use a phrase, so ridiculous in such a connection, seemed to die out of its own vapidity, without coming, or being by anybody expected to come, to any resuit. The Lord Chancellor then threw down a bundle of papers from his desk to the gentleman below him, and somebody said, "Jarndyce and Jarndyce." Upon this there was a buzz, and a laugh, and a general withdrawal of the bystanders, and a bringing in of great heaps, and piles, and bags full of papers. I think it came on for further directions about some bill of costs, to the best of my understanding, which was confused enough. But I counted 23 gentlemen in wigs who said they were in it, and none of them appeared to understand it much better than one. They chatted about it with the Lord Chancellor, and contradicted and explained among themselves, and some of them said it was this way, and some of them said it was that way, and some of them jocosely proposed to read huge volumes of affidavits, and there was more buzzing and laughing, and everybody concerned was in a state of idle entertainment, and nothing could be made of it by anybody. After an hour or so of this, and a good many speeches being begun and cut short, it was referred back for the present, as Mr. Kench said, and the papers were bundled up again before the clerks had finished bringing them in. I glanced at Richard on the termination of these hopeless proceedings, and was shocked to see the worn look of his handsome young face. It can't last forever, Dom Durden. Better luck next time, was all he said. I had seen Mr. Guppy bringing in papers, and arranging them for Mr. Kench, and he had seen me, and made me a forlorn bow, which rendered me desirous to get out of the court. Richard had given me his arm, and was taking me away, when Mr. Guppy came up. I beg your pardon, Mr. Carstone, said he in a whisper, and Miss Summerson's also, but there's a lady here, a friend of mine, who knows her, and wishes to have the pleasure of shaking hands. As he spoke, I saw before me, as if she had started into bodily shape from my remembrance, Mrs. Rachel of my godmother's house. How do you do, Esther? Said she. Do you recollect me? I gave her my hand, and told her yes, and that she was very little altered. I wonder you remember those times, Esther, she returned with her old asperity. They are changed now. Well, I am glad to see you, and glad you are not too proud to know me. But indeed she seemed disappointed that I was not. Proud, Mrs. Rachel, I remonstrated. I am married, Esther, she returned, coldly correcting me, and am Mrs. Chadband. Well, I wish you good day, and I hope you will do well. Mr. Guppy, who had been attentive to this short dialogue, heaved a sigh in my ear, and elbowed his own, and Mrs. Rachel's way through the confused little crowd of people coming in and going out, which we were in the midst of, and which the change in the business had brought together. Richard and I were making our way through it, and I was yet in the first chill of the late unexpected recognition when I saw, coming towards us, but not seeing us, no less a person than Mr. George. He made nothing of the people about him as he tramped on, staring over their heads into the body of the court. George, said Richard as I called his attention to him. You are well met, sir, he returned. And you, miss? Could you point a person out for me, I want? I don't understand these places. Turning as he spoke, and making an easy way for us, he stopped when we were out of the press in a corner behind a great red curtain. There's a little cracked old woman, he began, that, I put up my finger, for Miss Flight was close by me, having kept beside me all the time, and having called the attention of several of her legal acquaintance to me as I had overheard to my confusion, by whispering in their ears, hush! Fitz Jarndyce on my left. Hem, said Mr. George. You remember, miss, that we passed some conversation on a certain man this morning? Gridley, in a low whisper behind his hand. Yes, said one. He is hiding at my place. I couldn't mention it. Hadn't his authority. He is on his last march, miss, and has a whim to see her. He says they can feel for one another, and she has been almost as good as a friend to him here. I came down to look for her, for when I sat by Gridley this afternoon, I seemed to hear the roll of the muffled drums. Shall I tell her? Said one. Would you be so good? He returned with a glance of something like apprehension at Miss Flight. It's a providence I met you, miss. I doubt if I should have known how to get on with that lady. And he put one hand in his breast, and stood upright in a martial attitude as I informed little Miss Flight, in her ear, of the purport of his kind errand. My angry friend from Shropshire. Almost as celebrated as myself, she exclaimed. Now really, my dear, I will wait upon him with the greatest pleasure. He is living concealed at Mr. George's, said one. Hush! This is Mr. George. Indeed, returned Miss Flight. Very proud to have the honor. A military man, my dear. You know, a perfect general. She whispered to me. Poor Miss Flight deemed it necessary to be so courtly and polite, as a mark of her respect for the army, and to curtsy so very often, that it was no easy matter to get her out of the court. When this was at last done, and addressing Mr. George as general, she gave him her arm. To the great entertainment of some idlers who were looking on, he was so discomposed, and begged me so respectfully not to desert him, that I could not make up my mind to do it, especially as Miss Flight was always tractable with me, and as she too said, Fitzjarndyce, my dear, you will accompany us, of course. As Richard seemed quite willing, and even anxious, that we should see them safely to their destination, we agreed to do so. And as Mr. George informed us that Gridley's mind had run on Mr. Jarndyce all the afternoon, after hearing of their interview in the morning, I wrote a hasty note in pencil to my guardian, to say where we were gone, and why. Mr. George sealed it at a coffee house, that it might lead to no discovery, and we sent it off by a ticket porter. We then took a hackney coach, and drove away to the neighborhood of Leicester Square. We walked through some narrow courts, for which Mr. George apologized, and soon came to the shooting gallery, the door of which was closed. As he pulled a bell handle which hung by a chain to the doorpost, a very respectable old gentleman with gray hair, wearing spectacles, and dressed in a black spencer and gaiters and a broad-brimmed hat, and carrying a large gold-beaded cane, addressed him. "I ask your pardon, my good friend," said he, "but is this George's shooting gallery?" "It is, sir," returned Mr. George, glancing up at the great letters in which that inscription was painted on the whitewashed wall. "Oh, to be sure," said the old gentleman, following his eyes. "Thank you. Have you rung the bell?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.